Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, and welcome to Speak Up. For Tuesday, October 1st, we are in the Halloween month here. My name is Magnus Teevels, and joining me in the studio today...
Iago Santana Moreira.
And we have a couple good things for you on the schedule for today. We're going to bring you part two of Logan Hathaway's two-part interview on queer resistance against Israeli oppression in Palestine. And Iago has a couple features for us, too.
Yes, for the second segment of the Speak Up today, we'll be focusing on the October 19th BC legislative elections and the critical role of student vote. I'll be here with Joe Gelani, VP of External Affairs of the Student Society of SFU, and also Cole Rainbow, the Secretary Treasurer of the Federation of Students of British Columbia. And we're just trying to understand how local student voice can be shape the BC's political landscape.
Excellent. So let's get going with Logan's interview. This is an interview she did during the summer. Logan Hathaway was one of our summer student employees here this summer, helping out the station in all sorts of ways. And this was part of some of the Queer Pride programming that she created with her colleague, Stella Carter. This interview will be available online on the CJSF website later. And as I said before, it's part two of a two-part interview. And part one will be available also on our website today if you want to go back and check out the Speak Up program for last Tuesday. So here is Logan's interview.
This is the second of a two-part interview series with two queer Vancouver-based organizations who fight for a liberated Palestine. I interview three activists to discuss how imperialist powers, and more specifically, the Israeli state, invisibilizes Palestinian genocide, how queerness is weaponized by the West, yet how queer liberation is essentially connected to Palestinian liberation, and provide a more thorough and rooted understanding of the Palestinian struggle. I interview Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, QUAIA. They formed in response to pinkwashing at the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, yet that is not their only campaign. They also bring queer and trans people into the Palestinian struggle. They have unequivocal solidarity with Palestine. The Queer Collective for Palestine stands on these grounds as well, QC4P. They formed more recently to practice direct actions, especially during Pride season, and they emphasize that they take leadership from queers in Palestine. I will quickly summarize what we talked about in the first part of this interview, but after this, you should go listen at cjsf.ca under Pride Programming to hear the full version. In the first part, we discussed what brought the three activists into the Palestinian struggle and what solidarity looks like within a settler colonial state of so-called Canada. We discussed why BDS is an effective strategy. BDS, for those that don't know, is boycott, divest, and sanction, and why we need complicit companies to divest from the Zionist state. We also discussed PACB, which is the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. The organizers touch on how we need to entrench solidarity within organizations. In a time where Palestine is a central issue, we've learned from movements such as Black Lives Matter that we need to solidify this commitment, to change words and statements into concrete actions. We touched on what liberal anti-Zionism is and the history of LGBTQ+ solidarity with Palestine, from the Toronto Pride's banning of queers against Israeli apartheid to current queer solidarity. Queer people have always been fighting for Palestine, but how has this looked? We also discussed how the fight for queer liberation is connected to the fight for liberated Palestine. We outlined how homophobia and transphobia are inherently connected with colonization and the erasure of queer people within Palestine. And now for the second part. both of your organizations have really centralized around Israeli pinkwashing and fighting against that. Could you go over what Israeli pinkwashing means, what it does, and then after, how does it enforce colonialism and imperialism? QUAIA, could you start us off?
Sounds good. Yeah, I think, you know, there's many definitions of pinkwashing. I think a really accessible one is simply that pinkwashing, you know, describes, like, it can apply. It's not just to the Israeli government, but if we're going to talk about Israel, it describes the Israeli state and government's propaganda strategy that cynically exploits 2S LGBTQIA plus rights to project this image of being progressive while concealing Israel's occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid policies that are oppressing all Palestinians, including queer and trans Palestinians. So basically a very, very targeted campaign of Hasbara, and Hasbara basically means Israeli propaganda. So we often see that, you know, artists, Israeli artists and others are paid often and are often signed contracts specifically to promote brand Israel. And part of brand Israel is this pinkwashing campaign to promote brand Israel as their kind of rainbow haven for all people and like the beacon of democracy in the so-called Middle East, when actually there are a settler colonial state committing a genocide day after day in horrific and ever increasingly horrific ways. So I think it's important to kind of make those links and talk about the fact that it's a very specific, deliberate and intentional campaign. And of course, pinkwashing can apply to other contexts as well. And so I think it's important to make that link in terms of pinkwashing also here that we see from the Canadian state and government in terms of, if you know, as well as like so-called queer organizations. If we talk about like the Vancouver Pride Society and how they talk about you know, and seem to center and want Indigenous presence at the Pride Parade. At the same time, they had Bank of Montreal marching and other corporate entities that are right now engaging in genocidal resource extractivism off Indigenous lands. And as a result, Indigenous land and water defenders have been like jailed, faced police violence and state violence. So I think it's important to make the links there as well.
Yeah, and that also ties back into how all of these liberatory struggles, be it the Indigenous people on Turtle Island and the Palestinian liberation struggle, how they all intersect and come under one lens. QC4P, do you have anything you'd like to add? Just to go over the question again, what is really pinkwashing means? How does it enforce colonialism? What does it look like?
I think Quaya did a good job describing what pinkwashing means, so I'll just go ahead to say the way that it's enforced. I don't know if anyone has seen, there was a bit of a viral image that came out, I think it was in November, of a Israeli soldier holding a rainbow flag and something along the lines of like, this is the first time the pride flag will be raised in Gaza or something like that. Just really inherently gross. And so go back to how it's reinforcing colonization. I feel like there's this attitude that somehow Israel is bringing democracy to the Middle East or to the region, and that they're doing it partially in the name of LGBT rights, but they also use other struggles, co-opt other struggles to say that they're bringing some sort of democracy. So trying to understand how inherently racist that idea is when we think about historically just how much has come from the Middle East, the Swana region, to be treated as if they're barbaric or that they're somehow uncivilized, or because the same way homophobia exists there, the way that it exists everywhere else. And as a result of colonization, not as an inherent part of any religion or culture, to then frame that, oh, because these folks are homophobic, that they deserve to be genocided. So, yeah, I don't know if I missed anything there, but it's pinkwashing is more of the like the propaganda side that reinforces it, and then the colonization is all of the the acts that end up following and how, for example, also the media will be in a place to justify, or the media works in a way to what's the manufacturer consent before these things happen, and then after they happen, it's kind of reported on in a really, like, just the weird, I've seen the weirdest ways to describe how Palestinians are murdered, but those words are not the ones that are used. So,
yeah, if it's helpful, I can also add, I just thought of this, is that for listeners who may not be familiar with the term or new to a lot of what we're talking about, you know, Al gave some really important examples, and another one just came to mind, of course, is that with the Queer Film Festival locally, that one of the films that started our campaign to demand that they sign on to PAC-B was called Invisible Men. And I think that pinkwashing can be quite very insidious. And so this film ostensibly, at first, if you look at it, the description or you're watching the film, is about how queer Palestinian refugees found sanctuary in Israel, and it's from their perspective ostensibly. And so we're hearing these voices, so it can be confusing, and people are thinking this is, you know, a legitimate film, and that it's important to hear these voices, especially at that time. And I think that a lot of this analysis was new for a lot of people, and the conversations around pinkwashing were just starting to emerge. So what happened with the film is that when we traced the funding and looked at the funding, it was funded in part by the Israeli state. And so it was clearly a campaign of specific pinkwashing and propaganda. And we also, you know, in speaking with Al-Kaus, were informed that those queer Palestinian refugees in the film were very exploited by the Israeli filmmakers. So I think that's a really good tangible example for people, that sometimes it's not clear right away, but it's really important. And that is, I think, really the strength of the BDS movement in particular, and the National BDS Committee, which is a global committee that's been overseeing the BDS movement, or has been coordinating many of the kind of global actions for so many years, is that there are rigorous guidelines and, like, you know, ways in which it's that we can follow as organizers, and ways in which we can trace and go right back to the origins to try to find out, even when they're obscured, where and who is actually funding these films, despite the fact that they may proclaim that they're fighting for Palestinian freedom.
That was a really good example. Yeah, of tracing it back to the economic ties really highlights the weaponization of queerness.
Yeah, it's not always easy to do. And so it's important to, like, dig and dig. And sometimes you may not be able to find the answer, but I think often if you keep going, and I think we've, you know, seen that even with some other recent work that Elle and Kwaya have done together around, you know, looking at some films, a film that at first didn't seem to have any links, but, you know, the more you dig, the more you find out. And sometimes it can take a lot of research, because now they're starting to really deliberately obscure their ties. So, you know, may not see an Israeli state body, right, which is makes the film boycottable, for example, when we're talking about films. But then there may be other ties that have gone through a foundation, or there's other links that ostensibly are, like, you know, organizations fighting for social justice. But when you dig deeper, that's when you find the information.
Yeah. And actually, I did want to focus a bit on the boycott that Queers Against Israeli Apartheid did. So you guys managed to actually have the Vancouver Queer Film Festival commit to not collaborating with complicit Israeli cultural institutions or present cultural products commissioned by official Israeli bodies. So you guys were struggling for 11 years. How did this come about?
I think the first part of that, the answer would be one word, perseverance. And, you know, that coming back to that line about we owe Gaza and we owe Palestine endurance. And sometimes that means 11 years of endurance, right? And so I think that I think at first there was a lot of momentum and we had a lot of people supporting us, I think, in the first few years, especially when we got a lot of international filmmakers and support. Sins Invalid, which is an incredible kind of, like, leading group, mostly BIPOC-led, around disability justice, and has really established a lot of the frameworks, intersectional frameworks around disability justice, and kind of, like, radical frameworks around disability justice that many of us, I think, incorporate into our movement work now. And so when they and these other kind of like filmmakers, because they had a film in the festival that they pulled, so we had a lot of momentum and a lot of support for a few years. And then, you know, this is why I think even from our own experience, we say that it's important to entrench Palestinian liberation into the organizational DNA. Is because we've seen ourselves the ways in which then that kind of momentum and even like kind of like Palestine trending in terms of queer and trans communities locally just died, right? And so the festival was able to DEI and I would say decolonial wash with programming, which was important, right? Around whether it's Black Lives Matter, Indigenous solidarity, other racialized communities, cutie BIPOC communities. But what that also meant was that it was became much more difficult to be able to criticize and to continue to get support. But we kept just coming back that this principle is immovable regardless of how much other programming you have. These are not oppositional movements, first of all, but at the same time, if you don't have Palestine liberation entrenched and they refuse to commit to, you know, PACB and stop pink washing, then what does other kind of liberation actually mean? How is it meaningful? So I think that over time, you know, support means kind of like broader support dwindled, but we just kept the boycott ongoing. We were also really rigorous in the fact that we didn't call for a boycott until we checked with the kind of International Palestine Solidarity Movement around BDS, so the National BDS Committee at the time, PACB itself. So we moved only with leadership and advice from Palestinians, especially queer and trans Palestinians, but the broader movement as well before we made a move like that. And then we declared a boycott. And over time, and this group of us committed to that boycott became smaller and smaller, but we just never gave up. And I think the key definitely has been that there was has been momentum that has been built after October 7th. And I think we just need to name that, right? There are a lot of new people who came in. There was a renewed kind of commitment and interest in Palestine liberation in a way we haven't seen for years. Even, you know, when we were part of the coalition for many, many years and decades, we saw in the broader Palestine solidarity movement locally, you know, sometimes you'd only have 20 people coming out to something, right? Like in a protest or a rally. So that shift, that kind of global shift and local shift for this massive momentum and support for Palestine definitely played a role. And when he put out an open letter, you know, more recently, we just got a flood of people supporting us. And I think that the Queer Film Festival realized that this is the moment in which people will refuse to be silent and will refuse to let them get away with this any longer. And I think that also within the Queer Film Festival, especially I would say the kind of like more like junior level staff, et cetera, in particular. But as racialized staff have come in more work, like I think also part of this like commitment, new kind of newfound commitment to Palestine, there was probably some pressure internally too. But I think that we made it very clear that either you're going to be accountable and do this, or we're going to continue to build the momentum, right? And I think they know that we were going nowhere after 11 years and that we have had many creative forms of resistance. We've had international support, and you know, also that's mutual, obviously, in supporting queer and trans Palestinians, especially in Palestine. And so they know that we weren't the kind of like group that was going to go anywhere and was going to continue to like escalate. And essentially, we said, expect us, right? And that meant that we were going to, because we did a lot of direct actions on site during their queer film festivals in previous years. And, you know, shout out to the group, like including the Radical Access Mapping Project and some of the kind of key allies who held that position for 11 years when we were facing also a lot of censure and were basically cast out, I would say, of like a lot of queer circles and opportunities. And we faced some personal ramifications and also as groups and stuff from the queer community, the same queer community in some cases, which is now fighting for Palestine, which is great. But right, we also have that juxtaposition that we find somewhat dysphoric for us. We're really happy that that's it's become much more mainstream. And we also know what it's like to be cast out. But we always have felt that's a very small price to pay compared to Palestinians being murdered, Palestinians being tortured, Palestinians being oppressed in such a multiplicity of ways. And compared to genocide, you know, it's a small price to pay. And lastly, I would just say, and maybe feel free, QC4P, if you want to add, but we, you know, worked with, you know, L, we worked with, have worked with different folks, but also a debt of gratitude to queer and trans Palestinians, including L and others who have been really, I think, putting themselves, folks who have been putting themselves on the line for this work and sharing their experiences. And I think that's why the world is mobilizing, is because we are all, you know, and I'm, it's terrible that we have to, like, that the world is demanding to see proof of the trauma and the genocide that Palestinians are facing daily in order to support them. So that's, I think, a contradiction in itself. But at the same time, everything comes back to Palestinian labor and the work that Palestinians have had to do for their own freedom.
Wow, thank you. That is genuinely so inspiring to think. For 11 years, even after being cast out, even with so much direct action, facing backlash, that the Vancouver Queer Film Festival actually decided, like, did commit, not decided, was forced to commit. And you touched a bit about on this whole, like, move, at least in the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, towards, like, having other programming centering around Palestine or indigeneity. How do you understand that? Do you find that to be genuinely helpful to the liberatory struggle? Do you critique it? How do you guys position yourself on that?
Through all the years that we did our campaign, you know, I think there's kind of this, I wouldn't say kind of, there are definitely, I think, have been smear campaigns and continue to be against Kwaya, because we are unequivocal in our solidarity and in our support, and have basically, I think, you know, been critiquing a beloved and highly social current, like a queer organization that has a lot of high social currency, where people get work, where people make connections, where artists are supported in the sense of, like, you know, it can make your career in many ways, right? So, like, it's a prominent queer organization that is seen and was seen all these years as being one of the more progressive ones. And so I think that that's where the disconnect also happened, because people were not willing to critique. They may even have spoken out. And, you know, certainly there's been people now in Palestinian front lines post October 7th who were throughout that process, knew about what was happening for 11 years with the Queer Film Festival and publicly supported the Queer Film Festival and were part of that DEI washing, you know, who I think that creates a contradiction, right, for us. And so I think that we never in those 11 years ever critiqued or tried to pressure, for example, people who are Indigenous and what an Indigenous programming or when the Queer Film Festival is doing that. Or, for example, Black Lives Matter did some co-programming with the festival while there was a boycott called. And so our approach was really that we have to think about, like, the ways that struggles are connected, and also not, for example, Black or Indigenous. So what does it mean to also ensure that there is space and not take that space away from people who have needed it in that festival? So really for us, the approach was to have conversations with people and say, if you're going to be in the festival in any way, then please raise this issue. Talk about the boycott. Talk about, basically, most importantly, pressure them to sign on to PACB. And after that, of course, even now, you know, there's work to be done around economic divestment, which has not happened yet. So I think that we, you know, the fallacy out there from those who have been smearing Kwaya recently or have smeared Kwaya before is that, you know, we're kind of rogue and difficult to work with. But in fact, we worked with both filmmakers inside the festival, outside. We've connected with various staff, particularly those who are not in leadership position, because let's be clear, those in management positions have a lot of power, just generally in the not-for-profit industrial complex. We had a lot of staff over the years who reached out to us on the quiet, many of whom are no longer around, who were, you know, worried about their jobs, but really in solidarity with Kwaya, who shared a lot of what was going on inside and how the pinkwashing was continuing in different ways. And what we told them, because they were like, oh, should I be quitting my job? I'm feeling pressure. And we were very clear, the pressure is not coming from us. We understand that we're working in a capitalist society. We also have a class analysis. And so we're not expecting you to quit your job. Like, you know, expecting people to quit their job unless we have mutual aid set up to, like, support them for the rest of their lifetimes is not something that we would do. And so we worked with them, right? And we supported them. So I think our approach was multifaceted, but we never gave up our boycott personally and have kept it up as Kwaya and as individuals until this you know, specific moment. And I think for us, it would also be important next to see that economic divestment piece. So I don't know if QC4P, you want to add anything from your perspective?
I won't speak for QC4P, but I'll speak to myself personally. Being able to be involved, even though it was near the end of the campaign, it was just so cool to be in the room and to see things on the front line taking place, and being able to work with the staff and realize it was like, at the time, if correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a unanimous decision to sign on to PACB. So it wasn't just that they were signing on to PACB, that there was like 100% support behind it. I think that was amazing to see and to be part of.
Well, I hope the listeners feel ready to take on another form of the Palestinian struggle in different areas of their life and in different areas of the institutions and the society we live in, now that we've heard about this success. And now going to back to the Queer Collective for Palestine, I was wondering, so you created your organization quite recently. What prompted you to form a group like at this specific time?
I think we had a lot of momentum and we saw a lot of interest for a group to form that was around direct action related to Pride. Yeah, we had enough people interested and we had the means to get together and realize we were all on the same front. And it was pretty natural progression to, and once we had experience working together in the No Pride and Genocide rally that took place on June 29, we were like, okay, like a lot of the same people that are still working with us now, that really brought us together to stay working on future actions and to become hopefully a longstanding group. Just to stay committed to Palestine. And yeah, Rosie, do you have anything to add?
I think, yeah, that definitely covers our history very succinctly. I guess maybe in terms of like why now, as Elle was saying, there was just like this natural kind of organic, the group, yeah, formed in a very natural way. And also there was just such a clear, I think, like presence of like queer solidarity with Palestine. And so making that like really explicit and joining Quiet and really like naming that solidarity and that intersection, I think was important and necessary. And there was a lot of strength to that. And I think that was also part of what, was fueling this group's like formation as an official group.
What do you want listeners to take away from this? What can people do with this information? How can people concretely fight for liberated Palestine within their own communities?
I think people who are listening who are not already involved or have not already learned ways to be involved in the Palestine liberation movement, I think first need to have their own internal revolution to realize the power that they hold as individuals. Because if you feel like, oh, I could do that, but it's not really going to make a difference, then you're already giving away your own agency. So I feel like it's more than just being about Palestine, but trying to kind of wake up and realize just how much change you can affect as one person. So that's just the baseline, is to be aware of your own agency, but then obviously to be part of the BDS movement, boycott the main targets on the BDS national list. I know there might also be other boycotts you might hear about locally, once you hear some employers are Zionists or they've been treating their workers badly if their workers are showing solidarity with Palestine. There's nothing wrong with showing solidarity and boycotting, but we have to remember that boycotts only work when they're targeted and enough people are around the same target. So there's nothing wrong with taking on as many boycotts that you feel your heart desires, but to stay dedicated to the BDS nationalist